Welcome to the inaugural episode of The Book Club. I am Michael Knowles. Today, to get started real easy, we will determine the meaning of life by reading Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. But before we get to that, I've got to thank our friends over at Thinker. In our fast-paced world, it is very difficult to take the time to read a book. It's hard to find any time at all. Thankfully, at Thinker, thinker.org, you can go and check out the key ideas from all the great nonfiction books, all of them ever written. You can go to classics of America, like Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People, to modern classics like Jordan Peterson's 12 Rules for Life. If you want to challenge your preconceptions, if you want to expand your horizons, if you want to sound smart at cocktail parties, go check it out. That is Thinker, thinkr.org. There's no E in there. We don't have time for that. thinkr.org to start your free trial and put your mind in motion. To get this episode in motion, we are very lucky to have the man himself, Dennis Prager, to help us understand Man's Search for Meaning. Dennis, thank you for being here.
It's a joy.
You have talked about this book. You have written about this book. You have said that this book has had more influence on your life than any book other than the Bible.
That's correct.
Why is that?
I was first recommended to it, or it was recommended to me in high school by my dear friend Joseph Telushkin, and I read it in high school, and this is exactly what it did for me. Number one, it gave me the motto of my life. There are only two races, the decent and the indecent. This man was put by the Germans into Auschwitz. His wife was murdered. His mother was murdered. His father was murdered. And his brother was murdered. And asked afterwards, "Do you hate the German race?" That's the way they put it. He said, "Of course not. There are only two races, the decent and the indecent." That's why, by the way, it is not possible for a conservative to be a racist. Because that's how we divide the world. We don't divide it between black, brown, yellow, red, and white. We divide it between decent and indecent. That's one thing. Another was, I had meaning. I was blessed with a sense of purpose from a very early age. But I learned from him that the greatest human need, more than sex, so this supplants Freud, and more than economics, this supplants Marx, is meaning. You can be poor, you can be sexless, but if you have meaning, you can be happy.
This is what
he
writes.
But you could be rich and have sex, no meaning, no happy.
This is what he says right here. It's the key line of the book. Man's search for meaning is the primary motivation in his life and not a secondary rationalization of instinctual drives, that we are drawn meaning. And so, as you say, it supplants Freud, it supplants Marx, it supplants Adler, another psychological great mind who says we're really pursuing our will to power.
That's right.
But it's not that. It's the will to meaning.
And we are living, another, his great phrase in there, existential vacuum.
Yes.
The only thing he doesn't say that if there were a Pregerian version of this book, is the existential vacuum is a result of the post-Judeo-Christian world in which we live.
Right.
That's what the existential vacuum, he implies it, but he never quite says it. I don't think, I know that he had a positive view of religion. He spoke about the Jews walking into the gas chambers and reciting the Shema, the Jewish credo, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one." And that struck him as the exemplification of having meaning in life.
And he says, even this is the last line of the first part of the book. The book is divided into two parts. It's his story of the concentration camps in Auschwitz. And then the second part is his psychological theory called logotherapy, or a therapy of meaning or of reason. The last line is, "The crowning experience of all for the homecoming man," he's talking about leaving the concentration camps, "is the wonderful feeling that after all he has suffered, there is nothing he need fear anymore except his God."
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right.
The beginning of wisdom. I mean, that you see in the Bible, right. The beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord.
By the way, I, of course, never went through anything even remotely horrible like that. But I knew about the concentration camps at a very early age, and that's why I am sort of like that guy that he's describing. I know how horrible that is, and so even though I didn't go through it, I don't fear anything, because I know what terrible could be, even though I didn't live it. And that's the concentration camp. I am that person that he just described there.
And the way that we find meaning, because I guess I agree with him, man's primary motivation is meaning. How do we find it? He's finding meaning in this utter degradation. I mean, it's such an amazing story that he's telling. He begins, he says, I'm not going to put out a dry theory. I'm going to tell you what I saw, how the human mind experiences the concentration camps. And he sees his body melting away. He's turning into skin and bones. And yet he's finding there still dignity. And in this utter slavery, in this utter degradation, he says he still has freedom. I mean, it's an amazing aspect of this book. It's about the worst kind of slavery, and yet what he finds there is this ultimate freedom that you can't take away.
Because this was new to me in high school. This helped shape my life. There are times you are not free to determine what happens to you. You are only free, even in a Nazi death camp, you are free with regard to how you react.
Exactly. This point jumped out at me in the book, and it's something I think that people have completely forgotten today, but it's how we react to suffering. I think the way we think about suffering is that suffering is just a totally evil thing, suffering itself. But that's not what Viktor Frankl thinks. Viktor Frankl says suffering, even in a Nazi death camp, can be an opportunity for spiritual growth, because even there you have the ability to react to it, your attitude. You can find meaning there. He says that there are three ways to find meaning in your life. He says, according to his idea, logotherapy, we can discover meaning in life by creating a work or doing a deed, by experiencing something or encountering someone, and by love. the attitude we take towards suffering, all of which requires love. The direct quote from the book, love is the only way to grasp another human being in the innermost core of his personality.
And he really loved his wife. He was 24. People probably think he was middle age when they think about that. He was 24. So he obviously got married from our perspective at an early age. And he lived in part to meet her again. And he didn't.
When he talks about leaving the concentration camps, all the people who were killed, all the people who made it out, he said, the best of us never came
home. That's right. I've thought about that line my whole life, because I have thought, I don't know how many people think this. It's an interesting question. And whether Jews are more likely to think about it than non-Jews, because it was obviously done to Jews. But I've thought about it the whole time. What type of person would I have been in a Nazi death camp? And of course, there's no way to know.
Right.
It's ludicrous in some ways. But it's a worthwhile exercise. And there's a part of me, I am very strong. I know I am. And I'm a fighter. And I don't fear almost anything. But I could imagine seeing what he saw and saying, you know what? It's not worth it. If
right.
this is what humanity has become, I'm checking out.
Right.
The Jews who went to the fence, I think that's the way they describe it.
They would run up to the electrified fence and kill themselves.
Yes. Two things. Amazingly, the suicide rate in Auschwitz was not greater than it was in Vienna.
Wow.
It was the same, which is fascinating beyond belief. But having said that, I totally get why somebody would have done it.
Mm-hmm. Of course. Of course you do. And yet, as you say, and as Viktor Frankl says, the thought among these men of their wives, of who was waiting for them at home, kept them going. It and yet you would get home and the person wasn't there so often.
Yes.
On this point of love as being the way to know somebody else, I think that actually tells us a lot about books too, and it's completely missing from the academy right now. It used to be that when you would pursue some kind of knowledge, whether it's of a person that you meet or of an old book, you would do it because you love it. You love the poetry. You love the history. You love people and you want to know some other person. And yet now, so often when we meet people, when we read books in the modern academy in this postmodern leftist culture, we're taught to hate that other person. That other person is racist. He's a sexist. He's a bigot. The person I'm reading is awful and terrible, and we've got to deconstruct it and rip it apart and figure out everything that's wrong about Shakespeare or everything that's wrong about Viktor Frankl. Absolutely backwards, according to him. Love is the only way you're going to know anybody.
Yeah, that's right. And you're right in saying that it doesn't only apply to a person. That, look, the more you love, I've talked about this on my Happiness Hour on my radio show. The more you love, even the more you have passion about, the happier a person you will be. And the other thing about love is, as I tell my grandchildren, it's not a pie. You take a slice out of a pie, so there's less pie left. But with love, it doesn't work that way.
Right.
So I'm thrilled the more people, I don't want to be the only love object of my grandchildren. I love that they love all their grandparents. I think that's great. And uncles and aunts, the more the merrier. I know how, it doesn't diminish. A lot of people think if the kid loves me, then I don't want them to love the other one. Mm-hmm. Like, especially after a divorce, there are some bitter spouses, only love me, which is terrible for the child to begin with. But anyway, love is great. There's no question. And loving a book, that is correct.
Right.
Or loving Beethoven. I mean, you know, I love that stuff.
I mean, in this, the framework that he sets up, as he's describing living on a few crumbs of bread a day, some thin soup every day, he describes what happens when people lose hope.
Is that powerful?
He describes, he said he could tell when someone was about to die because they had lost hope, they had lost the will to live because they were smoking their cigarettes.
That's right.
If you had cigarettes, you would trade them for food if
right,
you wanted
but
to
if
live.
If you smoked it, that was like your last meal.
That was your last meal you were, and they would be gone.
The interesting thing was when they thought in 1944 that by Christmas they'd be liberated. And they weren't, and the death rate went up.
Mm-hmm.
Hope is a big deal.
Hope is a big deal. And what you do in the face of this despair or in this adversity, what Frankl observes in the camps and through his psychological work is maybe the opposite of what you might think or of what people seem to think today. He writes an amazing line in here. He says, "Psychological observations of the prisoners have shown that only the men who allowed their inner hold on their moral and spiritual selves to subside eventually fell victim to the camp's degenerating influences." That it was actually, you might think that in the face of all this horror, live it up however you can. Let go of any moral preconceptions you can. Just try, do anything. And yet what he says is, the surest way to lose your life.
That is why in high school I led an anti-cheating campaign.
Of course you did.
Well, by the way, I learned a lot from it because they elected me class president, and I learned you could tell people to be better and not be resented. Because I never did it in a self-righteous manner. I'm not a saint.
Right.
And I was clear, and it wasn't an issue. But I remember telling my friend, you know, our classmates are almost all cheating, and it may seem trivial, but it isn't. This is their test.
Mm-hmm.
They're not holding people up in the street because they don't need to. This is their test. That's why I think it's not a good idea to compromise on little stuff morally. That's his point, because you don't stop.
Mm-hmm.
That's the question people ask me. Should my kid at college write what they really believe and get a lower grade from a left-wing professor? And my argument is yes, because once you start compromising for a grade,
exactly.
When are you going to stop compromising?
He points out here a line, you know, it's a line that Churchill said. Churchill said, "The destiny of man is not measured by material computations. When great forces are on the move in the world, we learn that we're spirits, not animals." And he talks about this, these what would appear to be trivial little questions about our spiritual selves. In the book, these prisoners could, as they're feeling their physical degradation, they could allow their spirits to degrade too. But they don't have to. He says there is no conceivable circumstance in which human beings don't even have a little bit of freedom to do the right thing, to be a good person. But then he indicts all of us, not the people in the death camps, but the whole population. He says the consciousness of one's inner value is anchored in higher, more spiritual things and cannot be shaken by camp life. But how many free men, let alone prisoners, possess it?
Exactly. That's my point. That was my cheating point. Or the don't speak your mind at college because you're afraid of the grade you'll get.
Yep. Our life will not be measured by the grades that we get. It will be measured by what we do with our inner lives.
Yes, that is. It's really interesting because if you really do lead a life guided by what is right, you think in the short run you will lose. And you may in fact, but not in the long run. Life is a marathon, not a sprint. I didn't come up with that. It's a cliche, but a lot of cliches are true.
Right. They
got there for a reason. That's a very important thing for young people to remember. You know, the most important thing is not what graduate school or college you'll get into. That's only important now, mm-hmm. but not in the long run.
Well, you know, the hope he finds throughout this book is ultimately in this higher place. It's ultimately spiritual. It ultimately comes to God. You know, he quotes the Gospel of John. He talks about the Lord's Prayer. He's constantly looking past the degradation that's all around him because as harrowing, as unfathomably awful as that death camp was, it was a tiny portion of his life. And he says in it that his therapeutic approach, logotherapy, doesn't only look to the past. It also looks to the future to find meaning for your life. But then the question I have for you, you go to a lot of college campuses, you're in the culture all the time. It seems to me that less and less we care about meaning. We're robbing even basic institutions of meaning.
Right. Well, interestingly, we're living the proof of his point of the existential vacuum. For me, the left is the embodiment of the problem of existential vacuum. Having rejected God and country, essentially, which were basic to Western man's values in the 20th century. God is basically nothing, or is there just a word? And religion is rejected. 40% of millennials are N-O-N-E-S, nuns, no religion. And of course, country, give me a break. Nationalism is evil, is co-equal to fascism. So what's left? And so what's left is transgender rights. I'm not mocking the transgender. I'm talking about they have to fill their life with meaning.
And that's the best
that's
example.
That's what leftism is.
That's the best example because even if we're confused about the meaning of many things in this world, we used to know the meaning of what it was to be a man or a woman, and yet we've robbed even our sex.
They're a force of chaos. That's my biggest analysis of the left.
So
I wish he were around for me to ask him. No, you know, by the way, big regret of mine, I could have met him.
Really?
Yes. It's people should know, take advantage of whatever opportunity you can. You don't know the opportunity will last forever. I could have met him. I could have probably had him on my radio show. And he wasn't even far away. I've been in LA. He was in San Diego. And I don't know why I didn't. How could I? I don't know. To this day, I don't know why I didn't. It's so impacted my life. The guy's 90 miles away. And what am I doing?
Well, the bright side of that, I guess, in the hopeful theme of Man's Search for Meaning, is even though we don't get to talk to most of these
great
guys.
The hopeful theme of your whole
of the whole
book
show.
Program
because
is you meet people through their works.
You get to meet them. You get to have a whole conversation with them.
That's
and
right.
And it is, I agree with you. This is one of the most powerful books I've ever read. But we'll have to leave it there, even though there's so much more we could say.
But it was a well done, Michael. And this is a very important project you're embarked on.
Well, thank you. There's no one better who could have helped
thank
kick
you.
It off than
thank
you.
You.
And thank you. And then you'll have to come back on to talk about the other 7 million books that you've read and some that you've written.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dennis.
You bet.
That is The Book Club. Be sure to tune in next month. I'm Michael Knowles. Happy reading. Thank you so much for watching this episode of The Book Club on PragerU. PragerU is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, so we rely on donations from viewers like you to keep this content on the air. Please consider making a tax-deductible contribution today to help keep this content coming. Thank you very much.